There's something right in the world today. I think I can see what it is. Some things I share from my mind. I'm seeing things in a different way. Don't care if God thinks it's his. It's quite a big surprise. I've stepped off the edge. 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 There's something right with the world today. We share it with our kid. But so many they still die. But we kill our planet for the resources in her skin. Then mister, you're about to die. I've stepped off the edge. We can help our friends from dying. Staying in the past, you can't help yourself at all. Stepping off the edge, you can dream yourself is flying. Stepping off the edge. Tell you what I think about our situation. Decentralization, acceleration, it's exciting to me. But the television tells you that the money matters. Since you know it ain't, start, stop spending, grow again. I know you can, my friend. A grain and a brain free of pain, less insane, smoke Mary Jane. Tell me what you think about the situation. Cooperation, obligation, it's growing on you. If someone tells you that they need a favor, even if you think you can, you should still try helping others again. I bet you'll make new friends. Again and again, and again and again, again and again, and again and again. There's so many things right in the world today. And everybody can right the wrong, so you go tell who you know, and don't let it go. Cause I'd rather be partying on. Stepping off the edge, we can help our friends from dying. Staying in the past. You can't help yourself at all. Stepping off the edge, we can dream ourselves are flying. Stepping off the edge, stepping off the edge, stepping off the edge. You can help your friends start earning. You can arm yourself with knowledge. They can't stop social barriers from falling. Stepping off the edge, you must help yourself, one and all. Stepping off the edge, you can help yourself. You can help someone else. Stepping off the edge, you won't hurt yourself. You can inspire someone else. Stepping off the edge.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the Stepping Off the Edge podcast. As that rather cheeky introductory song alluded to, I think there's a lot of things right in the world today. And this podcast is my little experiment to help share those topics with other people. So much of what gets promoted on mainstream media is filled with negative energy and focusing on all the negative problems that sort of get bundled up into what I might call doom and gloom, that I want to get past that, and I want to step into a direction that is better than what has gone before. Everything about this podcast, much like everybody's reality, is a work in progress. I'm still struggling to find a coherent way to explain what the larger goal for this podcast is, but the following is something I wrote some time ago that riffs heavily off of the Star Trek The Next Generation intro text and might give you a little bit of an idea.
Set your metaphysical sail beyond the final frontier. Voyage towards islands of innovation rising up from the sea of capitalistic opportunism. Our continuing mission, to explore the strange old machinations that have shaped our reality. To seek out new philosophies that are sustainable across every aspect of life. To boldly connect with those who have a spirit of novelty and co-create something better than what has gone before.
Thank you. One such person who has that spirit of novelty in spades is Travis from hiddenplacemusic.blogspot.com, and he is my guest this week. Travis is a graphic designer, musician, and new music addict. In fact, all of the music that you'll hear in this episode, save for the MIDI mashup you heard at the outset, was picked by Travis, and I'm amazed that all of it is Creative Commons royalty-free music, most of which came from ectoplasm.com. Be sure to check out the show notes at steppingofftheedge.com for links to be able to download any that you are interested in. You'll also find links to some of the other media that Travis and I make reference to during our conversation. Our conversation was centered around an amazing YouTube video from the RSA, or Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures, and Commerce. In it, author Matthew Taylor speaking about 21st century enlightenment. I've included some of the snippets of that into the beginning of this episode, but I highly encourage that one in particular that you seek out to watch, because the RSA Animate series that it's from, they have a very interesting way of blending sort of graphic cartoons to go along with the speech that wasn't necessarily put out for that intent, but the combination of those two different forms of media and communication make for a really interesting perspective. It led us through a very broad-ranging conversation. Some of the topic highlights include, does technology really make our lives better? Understanding short-term versus long-term shared goals? Is there such a thing as universal truths? Finding the others, removing barriers to communication, influencing the global agenda, change top-down or bottom-up, exploring the logic of laws, and ways to make it easier to ask the question, is this right? Along the way, I've mixed in some other media from Louis C.K., Joe Rogan, and one of my favorite documentaries of late, The Yes Men Save the World. If you have any comments, questions, concerns, suggestions, or any feedback whatsoever that you'd like to contribute, I'd be very happy to hear it, either from the contact form available on steppingofftheedge.com or by emailing me, jamie@steppingofftheedge.com. I do believe that's all the introductory remarks I had in mind for this introductory episode of the Steppin' Off the Edge podcast. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Steppin' Off the Edge.
The RSA has a new strap line, and that strap line is 21st century enlightenment. The original enlightenment in the 18th century was not, of course, a single cohesive movement. It didn't have a simple start and finish. So when we think about the core ideals of the Enlightenment, it's not simply a kind of historical process. It's in a way, when we think about how those ideals have shaped modern values, norms, and lifestyles, it's a kind of process of cultural psychotherapy. We're delving into what has shaped the collective consciousness of modern people. And that enables us to explore critically whether those values and what they have come to mean to us still work for us, and whether they meet the challenges that we now face. So whilst I don't underestimate the ability of human beings to invent and to adapt, in the end, on balance, I do favor the view that we need to live differently in the 21st century. And as the architects of the Enlightenment understood, to live differently involves thinking differently, involves seeing the world and ourselves from a new perspective. In critically examining what Enlightenment values have come to mean to us, what we can now bring to bear is powerful new insights into human nature. Insights that have emerged from a variety of scientific disciplines and social sciences over the last 20 or 30 years. Because Copernicus, Galileo, and Newton helped to lay the ground for the Enlightenment by revealing that the laws of nature not only fail to conform to religious doctrine, but also they fail to conform to intuition. So the Pope might have said the sun went round the earth. It might have felt like the sun went round the earth, but science showed otherwise. And I think that insights into human nature have a similar double impact, also unsettling our intuitive sense of ourself in the world. Most of our behavior, including social interaction, is the result of us responding automatically to the world around us, rather than the outcome of conscious decision-making. And in this sense, it's more realistic to see ourselves as integrally connected to the social and natural world, rather than as a separate, wholly autonomous entity. The research is clear. If you want to be a happier person, don't read a self-help book. Just have happier friends. And there are other lessons that we can learn from the more subtle and holistic model of human nature now emerging. You know, we're not very good at making long-term decisions. We're much better understanding relative than absolute values. And as we found out in the credit crunch, we are enthralled to what Keynes called animal spirits. Perhaps even more startlingly, we are very, very bad at predicting what's going to make us happy, and we're even bad at describing what made us happy in the past. So I would argue that the moral and political critique of individualism now has an evidence base. And it's with this in mind that I argue that 21st century enlightenment should champion a more self-aware, socially embedded model of autonomy that recognizes our frailties and limitations. Now, this does not mean repudiating the rights of the individual, and nor does it underestimate our unique ability to shape our own destinies. Indeed, it's actually by understanding that conscious thought is only a part of what drives our behavior that we become able to exercise self-control. All of this can enable us to distinguish our needs from our appetites, and our amazing human potential from the hubris of individualism. It's the basis for self-aware autonomy. The developmental psychologist Robert Keegan argues that successfully functioning in a society with diverse values, traditions, and lifestyles requires us, in his words, to have a relationship to our own reactions rather than be captive of them. I quote, "To resist our tendencies to make right or true that which is merely familiar, and wrong or false that which is only strange." Now, the good news, and it is really good news, is that there's every reason to believe that we can expand empathy's reach. Despite major departures from the trend, most terribly in the 20th century, the history of the human race has been one of diminishing person-to-person violence. Since the advent of modern civil rights, we've seen a revolution in social attitudes based on race, gender, sexuality. Furthermore, real-time global media have brought the suffering of distant people into our living rooms, and immigration, emigration, and foreign travel all provide us with opportunities to put ourselves in other people's shoes. There are reasons to ask whether the process of widening human empathy has stalled, and at just the time when we need it to accelerate. After four decades of post-war progress, levels of inequality have risen in the rich world. Tensions between different ethnic groups persist and have taken on new dimensions. Anti-immigrant sentiment has grown, arguably reflecting a failure by policymakers to balance the imperatives of globalization and the ideal of universalism with the empathic capacity of the communities most affected by change. From gangs to the impact of violent video games, there are worries about young people. Globalization and public deficits may mean that future generations in the West face tougher challenges than their parents. So the stock of global empathy upon which democratic leaders can draw has to grow if we're to reach agreements which put the long-term needs of the whole planet and all its people ahead of short-term national concerns. But the chain linking interpersonal, communal, and global-scale empathy is complex. Intellectuals, politicians, and interest groups, and think tanks spend an enormous amount of time debating what should be the content of universalism, which rights, which entitlements, which capabilities. But shouldn't we perhaps just spend a little more time exploring the foundations of universalist sentiment? What is it that enhances and what is it that diminishes our empathic capacity? Policy implications range from a continued emphasis on the early years of child rearing to developing schools as intelligent communities to exploring the way popular culture inclines us to think of other people. For example, a culture which prized empathy would be one which distinguished the healthy activity of public disagreement from the unhealthy habit of public disparagement. It's become a cliche that education is the most valuable resource in a global knowledge economy. I would argue that fostering empathic capacity is just as important to achieving a world of citizens at peace with each other and with themselves. But even were we to have more self-aware and more empathic citizens, they would still face dilemmas and differences of opinion. I want to encourage us to recognize that the question, what is progress, raises substantive and ethical questions which we should be more willing to acknowledge, to honour, and to debate. How are we to make those decisions? Of course, the utilitarian answer lies in maximising human happiness. And if progress is measured in these terms, we have done well since the Enlightenment. There is little doubt. The poorest citizens of the developed world now have better health, longer lifespans, and many more resources and opportunities than those who would have been considered well off a century ago. But sometimes it feels as though the idea that progress should be designed to increase happiness has turned into the assumption that pursuing progress is the same as improving human welfare. The success of the Western post-Enlightenment project has resulted in a society like ours being dominated by three logics: the logic of science and technological progress, the logic of markets, and the logic of bureaucracy. And the limits of the logic of science and of markets lie in their indifference to a substantive concern for the general good. If something can be discovered and developed, it should be discovered and developed. If something can be sold, then it should be sold. And the problem for bureaucracy is a tendency to put the rationality of rules above the rationality of ends. And so it's in this context that the 21st century Enlightenment project demands a reassertion of the fundamentally ethical dimension of humanism. How can we make it easier to ask, is this right? Is it to be a world where so many of us feel that the shape of our lives is dictated not by the ideal of a life fully lived, but by social convention and economic circumstance? Why should we cram education into the first quarter of our lives, desperately balance work and caring in the second and third quarter, and then feel that we're going to suffer second-class status and a fear of neglect in the final quarter? You see, rationality can tell us how best to get from A to Z, but without ethical reasoning, we cannot discuss where Z should be. So what we aim for can be as important to our well-being as what we achieve. As Michel Foucault says of Kant's own description of the Enlightenment, it has to be conceived as an attitude, an ethos, a philosophical life in which the critique of what we are is at one and the same time the historical analysis of the limits that are imposed on us, and an experiment with the possibility of going beyond them. To be responsible, to create a big society, to live sustainably, this is not simply a matter of will. The 21st century Enlightenment calls for us to see past simplistic and inadequate ideas of freedom, of justice, and of progress. Perhaps it's time to stop chasing those myths, to stop being transfixed by abstractions, and instead to reconnect a concrete understanding of who we are as human beings to political debates about who we need to be, and philosophical and even spiritual exploration of who we might aspire to be. Creative people who want to make a difference have a million and one opportunities and distractions. To engage them means an ethic which is intolerant of negativity, rigid thinking, and self-promotion, and instead keeps people constantly in touch with the words of the anthropologist Margaret Mead. True to the spirit which created the Enlightenment, true to the spirit which moved the founders of the RSA 256 years ago, Margaret Mead said simply this: never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
MIT or somewhere like that, and they're working on ways to record their whole life. They have these like huge, ridiculous-looking glasses with a video camera embedded in them. They wear like a little pocket computer, and they have all kinds of real-time software that does like facial recognition and text recognition, and you know, so you can, I don't know, if you see somebody, it shows, then they have like a little screen on their glasses that, you know, also shows when someone comes up, it shows you their name, and you can search
like
information.
Your most recent email conversations or your appointments.
Exactly.
That you're, oh yeah, I'm working on that document right now, and I'll have it ready for our meeting on Thursday. That's when it says my bosses say it's ready for it.
Exactly. I don't know how efficient it is at this point, but they've been working on it since the 80s, I think. So I imagine that there's a lot of things possible.
The question that's sort of coming up in my mind, though, is it making things better? There probably was a point when people's social network was small enough that they remembered every one of their friends' names, and they had a pretty good idea of what it was that they had to do over the course of a season. And so it wasn't necessarily that hard of a thing to remember that you needed a neural interface to look up such and such a detail. And are we really that much better off where we're at now when, I mean, it's fantastic that you can be in Germany and I can be in Canada and I can talk to you just by clicking a button.
That is very cool, yes.
But I don't know what the, sort of where the two ends of that line are in terms of positive and negative. And
yeah, I think that's kind of becoming a really interesting question these days, is kind of how far do we want to go with all this stuff? You know, instantly download, 10,000 songs onto my iPad and carry them everywhere that I go. Does that really make me enjoy music more? You know, all kinds of related questions. So that is a good point. I guess the idea is that society has kind of evolved to such a point that we kind of need these neural network extensions in order just to cope with it, which I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Probably not.
Everything is amazing right now, and nobody's happy. Like, in my lifetime, the changes in the world have been incredible. When I was a kid, we had a rotary phone. We had a phone that you had to stand next to, and you had to dial it.
Yes.
You realize how primitive, you're making sparks in a phone, and you actually would hate people with zeros in their numbers because it was more, it's
right.
Like, oh, this guy's got two zeros, screw that guy, why do I want to, And then if they called and you weren't home, the phone would just ring lonely by itself. And then if you wanted money, you had to go in the bank. For when yes. It was open for like 3 hours, you had to stand in line, write yourself a check like an idiot. And then when you ran out of money, you just go, well, I can't do any more things now.
Right.
I can't do any more
things.
That's
it, yeah.
That was it. And even if you had a credit card, the guy would go, ugh, and he'd bring out this whole chunk, and he'd write,
yes.
Oh, you have to call the president to see if you have any money. And
it's all true, kids. You had to call the president, yeah. It was ridiculous.
Yes.
Do you feel that we now, in the 21st century, we take technology for granted?
Well, yeah, because now we live in an amazing, amazing world, and it's wasted on the crappiest generation of just spoiled idiots that don't care, because this is what people are like now. They got their phone, and they're like, ugh. It won't. Give it a second. It's going to space. Can you give it a second to get back from space? Is the speed of light too slow?
It's true. Yeah. Yeah.
I was on an airplane and there was internet, high speed internet on the airplane. That's
yes.
The newest thing that I know exists. And I'm sitting on the plane and they go, open up your laptop. You can go on the internet. And it's fast and I'm watching YouTube clips. I'm in an airplane. And then it breaks down, and they apologize, the internet's not working. The guy next to me goes, this is bull****. Like, how quickly the world owes him something
yes.
He knew existed only 10 seconds ago.
Right.
That's what we're talking about, right?
Everybody has become so ingrained that when you're leaving the house, you pick up your cell phone, your wallet, your keys, and your cell phone's now your computer in the smartphone world of things, that it doesn't have to be that way, but a lot of people just accept that that is that definition of progress and leading to a better world are one and the same thing. And I think that the video sort of started to touch on some of those ideas, of how you actually measure happiness and how you can distinguish from something that you need versus something that you want.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's one of the points of the video that I really liked, that we are kind of realizing that we don't really know what makes us happy, and we're incredibly bad at guessing what it is. I thought that was a pretty interesting point.
Can you think of a particular example where you had something where it was, that is what I want and that will make me happy, but when you actually got it, this really doesn't make me happy?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely had that experience. You know, I guess the what always happens is kind of the real world gets in the way, and the thing that you thought would make you happy ends up being not really what you were expecting. I mean, that can certainly go that way with relationships. You know, you think, oh, if I can only be with this person, then I'll be happy, and then that relationship doesn't really work out, or, you know, the person ends up being a total jerk or something. Yeah, I mean, that definitely happens.
It's curious, though, that so much of the marketing that you see in advertising and stuff is you have to have this latest and greatest thing because it slices and dices and whatever action you're trying to do that much easier. But in reality,
yeah,
there's a learning curve that comes along with that tool or whatever, that eventually you might get to the point where it is that much easier, but you have to work to get there. And none of the advertising necessarily gives a good representation of that, how hard it is to get to the point where it might be just as easy to do what you can do now with the non-automated version of whatever the tool might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not to mention just the general stress of having so much stuff and the upkeep of all this said stuff.
and the rate at which all this stuff breaks down.
Exactly. Yep. I mean, that's kind of the, that's the whole consumer culture is buy more stuff because it'll make you happy. But I kind of wonder, like, going back to this idea of we don't know what will make us happy, I wonder, do people really want more stuff, or is it just that they end up wanting more stuff because the marketing tells them to want more stuff? I wonder if that's really something do we intrinsically want more and more things, or is it just kind of a product of this marketing culture? I kind of wonder about that too.
My own personal experience, growing up in the 80s, a lot of it was just Sega Genesis versus Nintendo. For one
mm-hmm.
reason or another, the different ways in which they marketed those two things spoke to different people, and people got mm-hmm. devoutly passionate about both of them. Are just computers. Both of them just allow you to play games, but the branding that they made an association with, once people got one or the other, they were like, they would have heated arguments, I remember, with some of my friends in regards to why it was better. And it was sort of a pointless thing that I look back at it now, and I can definitely say that advertising was driving a lot of the reason why, as soon as I heard about the next greatest thing, I felt like I had to have it. Now,
yeah.
A little bit older, hopefully a little bit wiser, having an iPhone, and the 4 comes out, and I'm like, yeah, it has a lot of shiny things, but so what? I don't know anybody else that has another iPhone 4, so the whole FaceTime thing and that sort of stuff is pointless, but it's getting to the point where it's no longer, it's like the individual feature of a product is better, and so that's why you have to get this whole new thing, where,
mm-hmm.
like, from a programming perspective, I see a lot of things going towards a pluggable architecture. So, you know, why couldn't the iPhone have a little thing that slaps in on the back, so when they come out with the new camera, you don't have to replace the whole iPhone device to get the better resolution camera they come up with. You just replace the one little part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, they wouldn't make as much money that way.
That's really the thing that drives at the heart of a lot of these questions is, does making more money make you happier? Does it allow you to buy more things, and does that make you happier? Or is it just sort of the spinning the wheels that you buy the next thing, you get to a certain level, and then you still come back to the same level of happiness that you were at a year and a half ago or 2 years ago? At least in my case for the iPhone, I have no intention of buying a new one, unless, of course, this one completely breaks down, which they've been known to do.
Yes.
Because there are many other things that I would much rather spend my money and time on than buying that new device.
Yeah, that's pretty much my philosophy with the whole iPhone, iPod thing. I've got an iPod Touch, and you know the new ones do multitasking, and they've got a camera and all this stuff. I'm kind of like, you know, that's cool, but my phone has a camera too, and you know, multitasking is nice, but I can also just close down one app and open up the next one. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, this is not really gonna make my life that much better.
No, but what I'm trying to understand in this idea that we're exploring of the advertising people put out the stuff to say, oh, you know, you have to have this. Some people, such as ourselves, recognize, well, no, I don't really. But what is it about the way in which they promote those things that get people so interested in it that they lose touch with the trying to ask the question of themselves, will that make me happier? Or am I just accepting what they're telling me as that will make me happier and spending my money in order to go and get it?
Well, I think really the ground problem with all this is just the fact that most people are not willing to or able to think for themselves. People just want to follow whatever's cool and whatever the latest thing is. I think most people don't really know what they want. It's hard to figure out what you want. So people just kind of go with whatever Apple or
the latest
whatever
it happens to be.
Exactly, because it's easy that way. This kind of ties in with really the whole of culture. I mean, that's kind of why I think a lot of people end up following a certain religion, because they don't want to bother thinking, what do I actually believe? What do I really feel? They just think, you know, somebody tell me what to believe, and I'll just, you know, do it so I feel like a good person. And I think that's really the ground problem of all this stuff. And that's what I don't know. Are they unwilling or unable to think for themselves?
Yeah, I know. I've listened to the Joe Rogan podcast a lot, and one of the lines that he says is that if anybody says they have all the answers, they're full of shit.
You're a fucking human being. And if you attach yourself, your mind, to any ideology, you're going to be on a road. And that road may or may not lead you in a good direction. But you're going to stay on that fucking road if you're attached to an ideology. And it could be a terrible road. It could be a road of, you know, circumcising your daughter's clitoris, because that's a fucking tradition. I mean, these fucking crazy bitches in Africa that cut holes in their lip and stretch them out to put plates on. Why is that? Because they got on a fucking road, and they stuck with that road, regardless of rational thinking. They didn't use rational thinking at all. They just adapted a predetermined pattern of behavior that makes life so much more simple. And that's what every fucking religion is. The problem is no one knows. You cannot know. You can have your own beautiful personal experiences. You could have been the person that was actually touched by God. But when you start yelling and ranting that other people have to follow your lead, or the fucking world's going to end and Christians are going to be taken away, I know you're full of shit. I know you're full of shit, and you know you're full of shit. And the real problem is that we can't say it, because everybody's got this freedom of religion, religious freedom, the freedom to express yourself. Even if you're expressing yourself with nonsense that helps scared, lonely, sad people lock onto that nonsense so they feel like they're a part of something. I mean, that's what it is. It preys on people whose lives fucking suck. So it's all nuts. It's not like your shit's cool and my shit's not. And it's not that, you know, yoga's the answer or fucking mushrooms are the answer. There's just questions. And until we're honest about that, we're never going to evolve. The human race is stuck in a giant quagmire when it comes to our behavior and our thinking about our behavior. But there comes a certain point in time where you have to pop the training wheels off. And you have to recognize that all this morality that you've developed is good, because it's good to treat other people good. It's good to treat other people the way you would like to be treated yourself. It's like a fucking golden rule, and there's a reason for it. And that reason is that we're connected in some strange way that we don't totally understand. Unless you are good to other people around you, unless you're kind and friendly, friendly and warm and loving, you're not going to fucking enjoy this life. You're just not. You're going to be problems everywhere you go. You're going to have problems everywhere you go. You got to figure out a way to enjoy this fucking life. It's not because of Jesus. It's not because of Moses. It's not because of anybody that may or may not have ever existed. It's because that's how you fit in better in the world. That's how you stay positive. And it doesn't have to be some shit that was written 5,000 years ago on fucking animal skins. That doesn't have to be the golden rule because it's old. You know, that's dumb. We need to figure out, like, now, today, what is, you know, the best way to live your life? What is the, you know, there's got to be ways you can be putting forward the most positive energy. I mean, we know objectively what's causing pollution. We know objectively what's causing birth defects and, you know, and we're taking in too much chemicals and not enough vitamins. We know objectively all this stuff. We know how to organize our world, and yet we don't do it. We know how to organize our health, and yet very few people do it. We know all these things. The right path to, like, being, like, a happy, healthy person is to do all the shit that we already know you're supposed to do. Take care of your body. Take care of your health. Take care of your mind, your stress. Meditate, be kind to people. We all know that. I mean, you ask anybody, they know how to get by and to be the most evolved version of you that you can be. I mean, it's not like a magical checklist. If you talk to people about it, you said, okay, here, you got a person, you want to improve them. What are the things that you're going to do to them? Okay, well, if I was a life coach, the first thing I would say is this guy's got to get on a diet that makes him healthy. I don't mean a diet just to lose weight. I mean just healthy foods in your body, many vegetables. Vegetables, a lot of good quality protein, a lot of water, stop the sodas, stop the bullshit. Start working out your body and get a better sense of, like, how this machine feels when it's moving. It's flowing better. There's less tension in it. Your mind feels, like, relaxed, and you enjoy every single moment of the day better. Step one. Everybody knows that step, right? What's step two? Be cool to people. Be nice to as many people as you can. Smile at as many people as you can. Have them smile back at you. Tip well when you go to restaurants. Just do the most you can. Be as nice as you can, you know, and just still manage to not have people walk all over you. Just get through this life as nice as you can. What else? Do what you want to do with your life, right? Don't go be doing something you don't enjoy. Don't do something that's, don't get locked into, you know, a car that you can't afford and doing something crazy because you need the money. Don't do that. Do what you want to do. Do what the fuck is it that you really want to do? Because if someone else is doing it, you can do it, you know? I mean, everybody makes their own path through this world, but a lot of people don't follow the path that they really fucking feel pulled to. You know, just for whatever reason, they got negative programming. You know, when they were kids, someone told them they couldn't do it, or told them to take the shortcut, or take the short route. That's a sad thing.
At least if you're having the questions and you're asking yourself and you're asking others, what if, why do I feel that way, how can I feel that way, or how does it make me feel, those are important processes to go through, because you, as an individual, we're receiving so much information coming in that, I mean, it's mass media, it's blasted at you, that you have to have a set of filters to look at that information and say, okay, I'm receiving that information. What am I going to do with it? And if you don't filter it and compartmentalize and understand the source of that information, the motive behind that information being sent out, and you just accept it as, oh, great, then you're doing what they want, whoever they might happen to be in that case, rather than what you might actually want to do with that information. That information, I think, some of it can be very, very good. Others can be very bad. I get caught up so much in looking at all of the things going on in society and saying, oh, it's mass media that's not out to get you necessarily, but that they have an agenda that is very different than what I think the agenda for a larger society should be. And theirs happens to be driven from continuing to generate sales and, you know, getting eyeballs on the webpage or any of that sort of stuff. That to get back to that idea where how do you judge what's better, which comes back to that question of how do we really understand what it is that we want or what makes us happy?
Yeah, I guess it's really an individual thing. That's the only thing that kind of bothered me about the clip, is that it was a very, these kind of broad general ideas often don't really interest me because I kind of feel like most of these things are very individual. I don't know that you can really define what makes a person happy because, you know, once again, if you say I've got the answer, then you should, nobody else, you know, it doesn't necessarily apply to anyone else. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it isn't. There isn't necessarily the idea of a universal truth. It's more the shades of gray that come along with that.
Yeah, it's something you got to figure out for yourself.
What I did like was the last quote in that video is saying that we need to reconnect a concrete understanding of who we are as human beings to political debates about who we need to be and philosophical and even spiritual exploration of who we might aspire to be. Contrasting that type of an idea of there's something out there that if we can articulate the direction that we want to go, then it becomes an easier process to step back from that and say, what are the points in the process that can allow us to get there versus sort of individuals or societies or nation states or what have you saying, oh, we're so focused on what's happening tomorrow and how big of a problem that is. Don't worry about, you know, 10 years down the road. You need to be worrying about the decisions about where you're going to get your mortgage for next month or, you know, how you're going to feed yourself next week or that type of thing. And if you can set a direction that you as an individual can agree to, and if I say that 10 years from now, I want to be growing my own food and I want to be eating healthy in doing that, that's probably an ideal that a lot of other people can get behind and say, yes, I would like to do that as well. The question in terms of how we go about getting to that ideal could be very, very different for each individual person. Some might be comfortable to say, I want to grow that food for myself. I want to get my hands dirty. I want to actually, you know, create it. Others might say, I've got a job that I'm doing that, you know, that gets me money. And if someone else is growing the food in my local area and I can support them and at key points in time, I can come and help out harvesting or whatever. And, you know, it takes 2 or 3 weekends of my time, but I contribute more financially to compensate for the lack of time that I'm putting in. Both of those scenarios still achieve that objective. And so they should be sort of held up to the same standard and say, we have a common interest, so let's get that common path. But there's such a challenge to people struggle to articulate what those types of long-term ideas are that it becomes hard to have a structured conversation with someone to say, okay, what are your ideas? What are my ideas? Where are our commonalities that overlap? And how can we work together to try and achieve those ones? And on those areas where we differ, then let's just be comfortable enough that we can go in our separate ways or do our own things as long as they don't negatively affect each other's environment to a catastrophic level, so to speak.
Yeah, maybe that is what it's about, is kind of, well, sort of a variation of finding the others, kind of get behind something and find other people and figure out how to make that happen.
So the finding the others concept, what can you describe for people that haven't heard about it or know any of the names that are involved in it as to what the intent or the concept behind it is?
I'm a little bit unclear as to who that idea originally came from. I first heard it from Terrence McKenna, but then I heard another talk by Terrence McKenna where he said it was Timothy Leary that originally said that. I guess it's an idea that comes from people asking these sort of gurus like Terrence McKenna and Timothy Leary, like, well, what should we do? Like, Terrence McKenna and Timothy Leary, they're always sort of spouting these ideas about a new world and all these kinds of things. And people want something kind of concrete sometimes, and they ask, well, what should we do now? And the best answer, or, well, the one of the answers that they would give is say, well, find the others, which is basically means find other people who think like you do and have kind of the same or at least a similar set of ideals and interests and intention. So that's kind of a summary, I guess. Would you agree?
I definitely would. And I think the thing that looking at where our generation is now and having grown up with the internet, how much easier it has become to find the others, that listening to podcasts that I can go on to iTunes and search for topics that I'm interested in, find other people who are out there that are having conversations on those topics that I am interested in, and begin to engage with them either through an online forum or Twitter or any of the other technologies that are sort of coming up. That what I think these things are really doing is reducing the amount of links in a chain that connect each individual to others, and so that it can be, you know, as we said at the outset, across the world. It also can make smaller communities more cohesive, and that's small scale. That's an impressive thing to see happen. When you map that out over the larger idea of finding the others, that the others aren't, you're no longer confined to your geographic boundaries. That's an impressive ability to improve the way in which we can connect with people.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing related to that is just the immediate nature of communication. Is it's no longer that you can, just the fact that you can communicate with somebody across the planet, it's the fact that you can communicate with them immediately. And that also gives that also can be quite powerful, you know, whether it's spreading news quickly, you know, within minutes, something happening, the entire world knows about it. And also, just kind of from big things and down to small things, where you can kind of get to know people. For example, Twitter or Facebook, you can kind of get to know people in a more intimate way, too. Just kind of people sharing random things throughout their day, which is more than just kind of, you know, sharing news articles or ideas. You're also kind of getting to know the person as well, and sort of it becomes a bit more personal that way, which I think is also can be quite a powerful tool.
There's a line there that I find funny, where it definitely is people are sort of freely sharing information that they might not otherwise if they weren't using those particular types of technology. But then there's also a certain hesitation, where I recall one article that I read that mentioned that Facebook is now becoming a cited source in divorce cases, and people finding out about others doing things that if they hadn't been using those technologies, they never would have shared that information. And so it's lowering those barriers to communication. But what's curious to me is how much of that is a good thing and how much of that might not be. And my general philosophy is that open communication and open access to information, there might be negative consequences that come along with it, but in a long-term view, it's far better that everybody can access that information. And as you look at it sort of more on the data side than on the communication side, if I were working for some government agency, if I put out this information that the people who work for that agency might only be able to do certain things with it, but when it's put out onto the internet, you then have 7 billion people who might have other ideas what they can do with that information. And there's been a lot of interesting, what I guess are called mashups, where you take information from one data store, connect it with some other environment, and you're able to get a better sense of what's that information is actually meaningful because of the connections that are created.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree that the benefits of free and open access to communication far outweigh the potential pitfalls and hazards. I kind of, you know, you hear all these sort of privacy debates going on, but I don't really get the big problem. I kind of have the feeling it would be better if all information was open all the time. I kind of feel like privacy is going to kind of disintegrate and disappear more and more as people become more and more connected. And I think that's a good thing, ultimately.
I agree, and there's a case recently that's come up with the WikiLeaks website.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really interesting thing I've been following with great interest, is putting information in the hands of ordinary people instead of keeping certain information confidential. Yeah, that's a good example.
What's curious, and for maybe for some of the people that haven't been following it, WikiLeaks is a website that when people have sensitive information that they want to publish, they work with those individuals, and I have no understanding really other than that they do it in a secure fashion to vet that the information that they're receiving is accurate and they publish that information out, and anybody else can have access to that information. And it means that if an organization looks at the information there and says, oh, you know, it's wrong that that information is out, that's our trade secret, that's a security threat to have it, and they try and take down the one web server, they've set their servers up as a distributed computing model so that it doesn't serve any value to doing that because the information is out there on other different servers. It really is a change in the philosophical view of access to information when everything is everywhere. There is, once something gets onto the digital ecosystem or onto the internet, it's very, very hard, if not impossible, to prevent it from going further than that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's definitely a good thing, in that it kind of exposes corruption, exposes people who are trying to misuse information. Another interesting example is, I don't know if you saw the documentary "The Yes Men Fix the World." Have you heard of that one?
I have, and that is a very, very great documentary.
So what we do is pass ourselves off as representatives of big corporations we don't like. We make fake websites and wait for people to accidentally invite us to conferences.
My name is Fred. I'm from Halliburton.
My name is Hannaford Schmidt. I'm with the World Trade Organization. I'm from Arizona.
My name is Francisco Guerrero.
Hundreds of oil and gas executives were duped today.
The Yes Men.
The Yes Men.
The Yes Men.
Louisiana officials are taken for a ride. Sick. Twisted, cruel.
And what they do is really to take absurd ideas, and they present these ideas in all seriousness.
The group has done this many times before. They have a track record of getting away with it.
One of the best examples I recall from it was they impersonated a chemical company that there was a massive leak in Bhopal, India.
And yeah, exactly.
Tremendous amounts of people have life-threatening injuries and diseases that have stemmed from that. And the area is a wasteland because of that. The company that actually caused the explosion got sold to another one, got sold to another major corporation, and they impersonated that major corporation.
Andy is about to go on live television in front of 300 million people. They're going to think that he represents one of the largest companies in the world, which he doesn't. And that's why he looks so nervous. Andy's about to tell a really big lie, which unfortunately is going to wipe $1 billion off one company's stock price.
You know, what really gets me about that, and I think it's a fantastic thing that they were doing, because their philosophical perspective was, this is something that that larger company can do, and we believe it's something that the company should do.
Mm-hmm.
The negative consequences of that was, on the stock market, there was all kinds of fluctuations and money lost, and sort of the financial institution was saying, oh, they're evil, they're spreading false information and that sort of stuff. But it really brings back that question of, if information is open and widely available, the right things, all things being equal, should happen or should rise to the top. And it made it easy for them to say, this is something that should happen, and at least it's promoting positive conversation around the topics that they're trying to bring awareness to.
Yeah, definitely.
Tying back to some of the questions that I had been thinking of in regards to the RSA animate video that we started out with, one of them was, how can individuals influence the policies created over short-term national concerns towards ones that address long-term needs of the whole planet and all its people? And I think that was, that the Yes Men is a really good example where they sat down and said, what is a topic that we think there's injustice happening, and how can we use the concept of pranks, which is their method that they find a great sense of connection to further the conversation. And that's three or four people, I think, that encompass the Yes Men, but they're making lots and lots of other people think about and have conversations about, and hopefully enacting change as a result of that. So that's one small step. Are you aware of maybe some others that come to mind along that line?
Well, there are certainly quite a few movements like that. Well, the Zeitgeist movement comes to mind, sort of getting together a group of people who are getting them aware of these kind of topics, the sort of problems that we're facing. And there's another couple guys I saw on YouTube. They go around in cities in London and in England with megaphones and shout things like, you know, everything is okay, go back to your TVs.
Everything you read in the mainstream media is 100% true. Please, go back to your jobs. If you have not got a job, you are a worthless human being. Consume, consume, consume until we have no planet left to consume. What you need to do is buy things that you don't need. That's the best way to support the economy. Thinking is boring. Thinking is hard work, and it's not worth the energy.
They're kind of making a scene, basically, a little bit like the Yes Men, kind of making a scene for the purpose of getting people to think for themselves. Usually when they're running around with their megaphones, usually the police show up or security personnel. And, you know, they're saying, you know, we have a right to free speech. We can make a scene if we want.
Ladies and gentlemen, the true thing is, I know we're creating a scene, but creating a scene is not illegal. You are born free, you will live free, you will die free. You are allowed to make a scene. You're allowed to scream for joy. You're allowed to complain. You're allowed to cry. You're allowed to love people. You're allowed to hug people. And we're starting to live in a world where we're starting to feel scared. We're starting to forget just how divine and special we are as human beings. Every single one of you is the only example of you that will ever exist. And there's not a single authority on this world, especially not private security men, who can tell you how to behave in any time, any place, anywhere.
The media is telling us to always be scared through terrorism and like the economic recession, so we're just trying to do the opposite and say that everything's fine. Okay. True happiness can only come from within.
I guess this kind of brings me to a point that I've been thinking about relating to this whole RSA animation. Is one problem I have, something I keep hearing, a lot of people seem to be looking for a kind of top-down approach and change. And that is they're sort of seem to be implying, you know, if only we can get the right people in government or install the right policies or make the right laws, then things are gonna work better. What I think is a lot more effective is a bottom-up approach where you change the minds of individual people, and that then in turn affects change on a bigger scale. Because the problem with changing laws and policies is the people are still the same. If you don't focus on creating self-aware and empathetic citizens, as they said in the animation, if you don't focus on that side, then it's not going to change much to add more laws and more policies and more government to create change.
I definitely agree in that the thought that came to mind as you were saying that was the quote from V for Vendetta.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
The idea that the more change that's happening at the bottom of a system, the less the laws that are created are going to serve the needs of those people. And it should become something that sort of looks back and says, what are people doing? What are the policies that can encourage the positive aspects of what they're doing to grow further, and that more people would do that? The idea that laws are negative reinforcement or trying to prevent people from doing things, I struggle with an understanding to really see why that has become the approach if it's not purely something that's driven from the idea of control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess people tend to think that laws are kind of the quickest way to affect change, the quickest way to kind of basically force people to behave in a certain way. But that's kind of the problem that I see with it, is I don't think it's going to work that way. Well, for one thing, if you install laws, I don't think it's necessarily going to help, not going to necessarily help people do the right thing. And for another thing, the whole government system, just getting those laws in place, takes such a long time that it seems kind of unworkable to me to attempt to, you know, get laws or policies that kind of fit our views better. It seems to be an inefficient approach, which is why I seem to think that changing the individual's mind will then force the policies to be changed because of the way that people are thinking.
The concept of finding the others, and that tie in very well, that the more people who you can find at what we might call the bottom of the system, who share the ideals that you have, and the more change that each of us can work to bring about within that, will have that much stronger of an effect bubbling up into the system. And so more people trying to do more things will make more of a better situation happen faster. And from the RSA Animate thing, the question that they thought one of the next topics should be is, how can we make it easier to ask, is this right?
Yeah, that one I had a hard time with. I think it's focus on making people more independent, thinking for themselves, and also to make people more, to help, or not make them, but to rather to help people see long term. I think that's really the best way, is to focus on opening people's minds and their thoughts to a wider perspective. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it very much does. The point that I take away from that is that if individuals aren't willing to do the work themselves and to try and create a better reality for themselves, then it doesn't matter how many government policies or subsidies or anything is out there for them. It's still up to the individual to do the work. And so finding the others is one small example where people are doing that and creating new connections. The yes men are other people who are showing their perspective on what they think a better future is and doing things towards creating that as a new reality. The RSA Animate video is showing what they feel are some of the questions that need to be
considered as we try and move forward towards that better society. And I think our attempt at this podcast is just another set of individuals coming together to try and both question the important questions that go into making that better society, as well as bringing attention to some other people as we start to interview others that are doing types of things which we think are better for society, and trying to share that information with the world. Summary of some of the areas that you're hoping this podcast might go, as far as topics and whether it's people we hope to interview or just the types of industries or things they're doing, to give anybody that's listening a sense of what they can expect in some of the podcasts ahead.
Yeah, sure. One of the things I think would be interesting to explore is whether we should look for reformation of the system, or whether we should try to create a completely new system. That's something I've been kind of struggling with and thinking of, is, you know, do we want to create a new government and new policies, or do we scrap the whole thing that we have now and start over completely from scratch? I think that would be something interesting to explore.
Very much.
And
so.
We could explore all kinds of variations of that. You know, what it would be interesting to interview people just to kind of find out what are some of the things they're doing to either the system or extract themselves from the system and form their own system. And of course, that could have to do with permaculture, you know, starting your own farm, growing your own food, those kinds of things, how to get yourself off the grid, basically how to become more self-sufficient. That could explore, you know, ways to get other people involved with that, kind of what is this new, if, you know, if people are making a new system, what does that system look like? What are some of the ideas we have? Yeah, how do we go forward? How do we affect change?
That's a really interesting area that I'm excited to hear what some other people are doing. And I know a couple things come to mind for myself. Some of the areas that connect with that for what I'm interested in is looking at sort of where we're at right now. And one of the examples that hopefully will be the next podcast is looking at some open source technologies and how they're enabling individuals to take more ownership of the publication process for what they're communicating. So, you know, to rely on Twitter or Facebook or publishing your thoughts on some other website versus having the tools to do that for yourself. And the example that I'm hoping will be the next one is an open source project called WordPress that most people are familiar with as a blogging platform. WordPress I see as an interesting model for discussion because it is an open source platform that automatic run WordPress.com, and it has I don't know how many millions of blogs, and they're a multi-million dollar company, but they are also putting the software that they run that website with out into the community and working with the community to develop different parts of it so that anybody who wants to run their own website that has a little bit of web development skill can do so. When you connect that back to some of the ideas of how the printing press changed the mode of communication in the 1800s, I think WordPress as an example of a specific technology on the internet is starting to have that kind of a level of change for our generation.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to hearing that as well. I think that's another great topic that you could cover is sort of open source technology and also this sort of idea of decentralization of information and technology, also crowdsourcing and cloud computing, these kind of ideas of moving away from a central closed system to a more open and modular system. And that could apply to all kinds of things, not only technology.
I find it curious that technology is sort of out at that leading edge of coming up with these ideas or testing the concepts. But the notion of open source or any of these other things, which can apply to any different walk of life, as far as you look at the medical industry, where right now, in order to become a doctor, you have to go and get this specialized training from a institution that costs a lot of money, and it's a very specific thing. But that information should be widely available so that anybody who needs that information can easily access it. And open source is proving itself as a method where you can balance the need for or the desire for specialization and having specific services that are offered and just putting the regular information out there so that individuals that want to do their own thing with it are capable, but it's not, the information isn't controlled by any one group.
Right, yeah, I think that's the important part, is kind of moving away from that central control groups into a more unified kind of field of many people and many groups working in a kind of modular and very adaptable system. I think that's a very interesting topic, for sure.
I agree. What are we going to call this thing?
That's another interesting question. Have you had any ideas yet?
The only one that I had was to call it Stepping Off the Edge. The perspective being that every individual is taking steps forward themselves, and they're all going in different directions. So at every point, we're all stepping off the edge in terms of where we're trying to go. As long as we're continuing to think about where we're stepping off the edge to, then it becomes a podcast to explore that particular topic. And as you said, each one of them hopefully can stand on its own as an individual podcast. When you look at it over the course of time and over the evolution of the podcast, you begin to see the pattern of the path that we're actually walking with every step that we take off the edge.
Yeah, maybe you could call it something like Stepping Off the Edge and then with the byline in a million different directions. So it's kind of something to give it this chaotic sort of undecided aspect.
It's not quite the shotgun approach to it, but it's a little bit more focused, but something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, Travis, thank you much for another wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you too. Thanks again for putting this together. I'm really excited to see what will come of this. It's a really interesting project.
Thank you.